The following message has been brought to you by Fairway Market. What's the buzz about honey? Well, those busy little bees are up to something, and it is delicious. The Fairway label honey is superb. Fairway only hires worker bees that are the best at what they do. This makes for a great tasting, high quality honey at an amazing value with the Fairway stamp of approval. And on top of being delicious, honey is a great substitute for other sweeteners and can even benefit your health. This includes better energy, respiratory improvements, and balanced blood sugar levels. It's a no-brainer. Get your Fairway honey today.
Burning down the house here on Sundays. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, architect and your host. This is the episode for the 11th of June, 2011. Just had to turn up my phones a little bit. Welcome. I have two things that I want to talk about today. In part one, criticism, architectural criticism, especially architectural criticism as appears in the pages of The Gray Lady, the New York Times. If you hear all sorts of ribald happiness happening in the background, that's because we are at Roberta's restaurant in the garden, and today they're having tiki bar time. And although we are a sound studio, we are not acoustically isolated, so there are hundreds of people dancing around, drinking beer, just feet from our humble microphones. Part two, I wanted to talk with a friend of the program, Ryan Inchity, about some recent ink that he's gotten, not in the New York Times, and he has some ideas about further articulation of passive solar mitigation on buildings, biomass as an ingredient or a component of a glass facade. And joining us in the studio is the architect, designer, and builder of buildings, not necessarily works of art, artful buildings, but real buildings, buildings as buildings, Jacob Allspector. Welcome back, Jake.
Hey, great to be here again.
Now, you have to remember that Jake's experiences with people who did art buildings.
I did them. Charlie Guathme and Robert Siegel, who just sold his firm.
No.
You didn't see that, huh?
What happened?
Well, this is probably not part of the program, but
everything is important.
Some guy, developer architect named Gene Kaufman.
I've heard his name.
He bought a majority share.
And Guathme Siegel.
And Siegel is now, it's now Guathme Siegel and Kaufman.
Holy moly.
And Siegel is now, I think he's a salaried employee, you know, he's got a buyout deal.
Wow. That is really interesting in terms of succession strategy.
Yeah. No. So basically, sell the mother.
So Mr. Foreman didn't step up and become a partner.
No, Foreman has been, I think he's been out of it there.
That's too bad.
For a number of months, if not a year.
It was between us and Cooper. Anyway.
Anyway, yes.
Yeah.
We did those kinds of art buildings. I still, you know, profess to do art buildings, but only in the limited sense of the art of architecture.
Yes, the art of architecture. Well,
Not the art of literature or the art of
Well, let's
whatever.
Talk about the art of writing about architecture. Here is the case that Nikolai Orisov, who has been the New York Times architecture critic for the last 7 or 8 years, And although he is better than the screaming leather-obsessed Herbert Muschamp who preceded him, your listeners should go back and look at the things that were written prior, over the years.
Architecture criticism got very personal at that point.
Yes, and if it was bold and brawny and had some phallic imagery, Muschamp loved it.
Have you done a study of this? Have you studied this, like categorically looked at the pro and con reviews and the buildings?
Anecdotally.
Okay.
I have a long memory okay. And let's not get into the
Are you
specifics.
Boasting again? Okay.
Am I blogging?
No, boasting.
Boasting. About my prodigious memory? No.
Yes.
No. But my point is that a lot of the criticism that was posted in the pages of The Gray Lady by Nikolai Urosov struck me as something he could have phoned in by just looking at snapshots. So here's, to get back to a recent project that we all are dismayed in, 41 Cooper Square, on 4th of June, published in 4th of June, 2009, Urosov had to say this about the Cooper Union Academic Building at 41 Cooper Square. He said, it's not a perfect building, but that it's a bold architectural statement of genuine civic value. He doesn't really elaborate. It's lively public...
That's vague enough that anyone could like it.
Yeah, or... Okay. Well, he doesn't explain what the genuine civic value is. Then he says it's lively public spaces. Well, there's no public spaces at 41 Cooper Square.
Just the arcade sort of overhang thing.
But that's on the outside.
And the auditorium downstairs, I guess, is public.
Yes, well, further to that point.
And the procession through it, to it.
For sure, there is the Rose Auditorium in the basement, but there is absolutely no clue, semiotic or otherwise, when you enter the sort of
See, this is
ambiguous.
What criticism's supposed to be like, everybody.
Thank you.
There you go.
The ambiguous...
Are you going for the job now?
I'm available.
Good.
If editors of the New York Times are listening or get referred to this podcast's content... You can reach me at info@heritageradionetwork.com. I'm Curtis B. Wayne. I'm an architect. I've been an architect since 1979. And I have...
76, man. I beat you.
A few thoughts about what architectural criticism should comprise. Let me just go a little bit further. It reaffirmed that enlightenment comes from the free exchange of ideas. See, now this happens to be a building. First of all, he doesn't really describe it. And second of all, I don't see any free exchange of ideas. Although he does go on to say that it and the new museum, just a few blocks down on the Bowery, both of which share in the conceit of a building wrapped in a gauzy container, which might be interesting. I mean, if you compare that, for example, to the studies of translucency and transparency that Diller and Scofidio have been working on over the last 25 or 30 years.
Well, they do screens, too.
They do screens, but their screens are interesting. If you look, for example, and I urge everyone...
Yeah, but there are other parts of their work is not so interesting. The one-liner ribbon thing, I'm getting tired of that.
I'd like to go back to their studies with translucency, which is what the new museum at 41... Cooper Square hint at being able to do. Now, if we were going to have real criticism, we'd talk about that as a conceit, where, like Christo, wrapping a building, and you wonder, or any other structure, and you sort of then have a tease of, well, what is hidden behind the screen?
Enigmatic quality.
Yeah, at 41 Cooper Square, what's behind it is... absolutely pedestrian and interesting, and at the new museum, it's below pedestrian. It's just a glass box. And so both of those have this idea of tease, and nothing happens.
I'll play devil's advocate, and although you know that I kind of agree with most of what you say, I'm going to just take the argument, the critical intellectual argument that it is the clothes that make the building, and that's what today's life
Yeah,
media-driven life.
If it's a clothes that makes
you said, you know, on the basis of looking at snapshots.
I'm so glad
well,
you brought that
all
up.
All that people do anyway.
Jack,
people.
If you could cue up the next song and track and just play it, please.
You change the way you look. Can you see that? Up close, it's exciting. And I'll tell you something, darling. You look marvelous. Absolutely marvelous. Absolutely marvelous.
And if that's the extent of architectural criticism, I rest my case.
Well,
I mean,
you know,
absolutely
it's
marvelous.
Looks, it's looks and taste.
Absolutely
and
marvelous doesn't
extent,
make it as architectural criticism.
I know. But to a certain extent, that's you know, one aspect of it. But here's the question. Who do architect critics write for? Do they write for
well, that's a good
professionals,
question.
Or do they write well, for some interested lay people, or do they have some other motivations?
Well,
and
let's
drivers?
Look at let's look at two other forms of written criticism that we find in our current publications: music criticism and literary criticism. The you know the book review section,
right?
Is very good, and music criticism is good for people who are not professional musicians or mainstream concert
goers. But what about the literary? Is that for professionals, so to speak?
Well, here's what I think the components of valid criticism are, and a lot
for
of
a public newspaper like the Times.
Yes.
As
because I think you have to write. I believe
architectural record, which is pitiful compared to
is
even
written,
the New York Times.
That's written for architects.
Yeah, but it's yeah. very little criticism.
Well, there's no criticism. It's
once
all
in a while.
It's all exposition.
Once
all right.
In a
so,
while.
A lot of this has to do with a 19th century notion of narrative, which we see in Wagnerian opera. Part one: exposition and description. Part two: it's part of description, I think analogy is important. If you're going to describe a work of architecture, because you're writing about something that can only be described with a word play or a word melody to describe something that is very visual, you really need to give analogies.
Well, it's more than visual. It's physical in its best sense.
Well, you remember that Robert Venturi
we're talking about
categorized
two-dimensional iconic image criticism yeah. versus three-dimensional reality.
Well, you know that. Okay, so
or even four-dimensional reality. So, when we talk about time,
well,
and
we could talk about five dimensions.
Like
all right, wait. We'll get to that. Analogy. You know, Venturi's got two categories of buildings. Either they're a decorated shed or they're a duck. Both of these descriptions are very evocative, and they work.
Right,
and
they're both two-dimensional,
and they stay with us.
Right.
And then we get to actual criticism: discernment, analysis, and assessment. Orosov says about 41 Cooper Square.
Now, where are you reading this from?
These are Curtis's rules for criticism.
Okay, cool.
One, exposition. Two, description. Three, analogy. Four, discernment, which then leads to analysis, assessment. Whether you have a conclusion or not depends on the who you are preaching to. If you're preaching to the choir, let them draw their own.
So that's all very logical, but then how do you criticize art in a logical way?
Ah, it's not art, it's architecture.
But there is an art of architecture.
Well, there is an art of architecture.
Which is different than the art of music,
well,
the art of literature, and we just said that before.
This gets to discernment and analysis, where architecture operates not only in three dimensions, the physical dimensions of X, Y, and Z,
but over time.
But also over time, the fourth dimension, and also increasingly the fifth dimension of cost over time, first cost versus life cycle.
Do you think
cost.
That's another dimension? It's time.
No, cost is different from time, because time involves then
I don't mean time
analysis
in the literal
of
sense.
How
I
is it going to wear
everything that is changeable, mutable, you know, from one moment to the next. As and everything about the building, that includes the cost, because the cost is something that, you know, you pay down over time. Nobody buys it.
Well, let's get back and apply my own rules for 41
cool.
Cooper Square.
I would
describe it as a crumpled net bag writ large on the landscape with a rip down the middle. Revealing.
Yeah, it's more like a corseted thing. Yeah.
What's the matter?
For a second segment.
Ah. Sure. In it revealing a pedestrian glass box inside.
Yeah, it's concealing it. It's
Jack
it's
is
totally surface.
Cued that we'd
I mean wrapper. It's
like
not
to have
surface,
another sponsor spot. So let's do that, Jack.
Really don't mind if you sit this one out. My words but a whisper, your deafness a shout. I may make you feel that I can't make you think. Your sperm's in the gutter, your love's in the sink.
Yeah, and I played that for a reason. Thick as a brick, tall. Goes back to, the 20th century. I can make you feel, but I can't make you think. Well, Urosov didn't either do feeling or thinking, as far as I'm concerned. Now, it seems...
Got a call in there.
That's not me. Or maybe it is. Now, here's a contender. In yesterday's Times, New York Times op-ed, Saturday, June 11th, 2011, Death by Nostalgia by Sarah Williams Goldhagen. I suppose from this we can suppose that she is the heir apparent to Nikolai Urosov because she is the architecture critic for the New Republic. She talks about a show that's up at the New Museum by our buddy Rem Koolhaas, of the Office of Metropolitan Architecture, OMA, in which she characterizes this show as accusing preservationists of aimlessly cherry-picking the past, of destroying people's complex sense of urban evolution, blah, blah, blah. And she goes on to say, yes, of course, some historical context is in order, and then gives a sort of a sketchy history of the roots of historic preservation in New York City, starting with the 1916 zoning resolution because of the Equitable Building down on Broadway.
Was this written earlier, or is this written just yesterday, for yesterday or the day before?
I don't know when it was written, but she says
sounds
that
like something
she
I
says that the way things work in Europe, where vibrant contemporary cities like London, Berlin, Paris, and almost any city in the Netherlands, without giving any examples, blend old and new without effacing the normal evolutionary processes. If I had written an article like this, it just restated the obvious again and again and again as an essay in college, where you and I both went at Cooper, I'd have gotten a C because there aren't any hard examples of what happens in Paris, for example, that is different from the community city planning process with Amanda Burden, or landmarks, or the landmark districts, and having to go before the landmark preservation
board. She's reviewing a show of Rem's, which has a certain
but then
proposition,
she doesn't really,
right?
She doesn't talk about Rem's show. It's just,
I haven't seen it yet.
One paragraph about Rem's show, and the rest is just, what my ex used to call word salad. It's just a lot of words.
Word salad.
Word salad. You know, you could pick a morsel here and there. It's still salad, but what are you getting from it? It's not even a Cobb word salad. There's no bits of chicken.
So who
chicken
should
in there.
This? I think that's because the audience is so broad for this.
You can write for the educated layperson and for the professional, and give specific examples. I mean, if we're talking about somebody who was a new composer, you might compare it then to an older composer by analogy. Let's see now. That was that's point three of Curtis's rules of criticism. Analogy, it is. To a certain extent, early Phil Glass had a lot to do with Eric Satie. It's reiterative patterns. Now, Phil took it to, Olympian heights of repetitiveness to the extent which an opera singer that I know who was singing the part of Nefertiti In his opera Akhenaten.
I think, I don't know. I think
he said that they just spent all their time.
He was very melodious.
Yes, but his melodies do repeat, and then they transmogrify from one passage to the next.
I think his thing was the dissonance thing, the sort of odd chords.
Well, there's that too.
And the sort of jazzy chords.
Well, the odd chords also happen in Debussy.
A lot of what he does sounds to me like
okay.
Like Thelonious Monk.
Well,
type,
you see,
but a different style.
This piece of work at 41 Cooper Square, it's full of odd chords, but there's no analogy here. We're left thinking that it's just wonderful, that it's a wonderful act of civic architecture. When it's not civic architecture, it's a private building. The public can't go in there. You can't just walk in and walk around. You know, you need to be specific with words. To call it civic architecture is bullshit.
Well, it's on Cooper Square, and it is an educational building in that sense.
Well, it doesn't talk about its place in the landscape other than being something that's new and wonderful.
It's not someone's house, right?
No.
It's going to be...
Well,
droves
to a certain
of people,
extent,
even
is.
Though they're a selective group. That,
to a certain extent, it is.
That use the building.
Phone here?
Phone? Sorry?
Phone?
Phone what? No? It's a wild and crazy day here in the jungle of Roberta's garden. Is my phone ringing? It shouldn't be. It's on silent. That ain't me, babe. That ain't me.
Mine's off.
Yep. So, all I can say is our good friends, the editors at the Times, surely you could do better. I understand that everyone wants to be the top dog in terms of my opinion is the best. Jack, if you could roll the next track and then get Ryan Enchity on for the second part.
Welcome to your life.
Burning Down the House here on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We've just finished up trashing architectural criticism at the New York Times. It ain't like the old
days of criticizing criticism.
Well, it ain't like the old days of Ada Louise Huxtable, who actually gave us some thought, something to carry forward, some ideas about future development.
Well, she had a lot of depth, and just, she was a great writer to compress
and she's still around.
Bunch of thoughts into things. And she had an open mind, and she didn't have a political agenda.
On the other hand, she thought that Michael Graves was the future of architecture. I remember that.
Well, he had a huge influence in spite. Yeah, I mean, you know, he influenced everybody.
Well, it's true. He really kind of launched postmodernism, didn't he?
I mean, we were amazing to have those guys as teachers. They really were influential.
Well, they had ideas.
Yeah.
And I simply don't see any ideas in the stuff that's coming out of...
No, a lot of it is what I call relaxed modernism.
Yes, Sana, who got a Pritzker, or Tom Main, who got a Pritzker.
He's not so relaxed, but it's still aberrant modernism.
Newly turned into the world of architecture, the Pritzker Prize, given out by the Pritzker family, who made their fortune in hotels, the Hyatt chain, is akin to the Nobel Prize for Architecture. I'm holding out for the...
Well, it's the only one we got, except for that Imperium thing or whatever it
is. Or the AIA gold medal. Jack, do you have Ryan Enchity on the line? Yes?
I'm here.
Ryan. Welcome to part two of our little Sunday rant. I was so happy when I saw a post from you. Ryan's been on the program before. We talked with Ryan about Passive House. And Ryan has got some interesting and tasty sketches that show sort of a passive glass facade with some sort of biomass incorporated. And I wanted to learn more about it. And rather than just having a private conversation, I thought I'd invite Ryan to come on the program and tell us what he's got in terms of thoughts about developing further towards energy sustainable architecture.
That's very kind of you, Curtis.
You have the floor.
Well, the project you're speaking of was a competition entry for an ideas competition put on by the GSA and Metropolis Magazine. And what I proposed was to address what is the, from an energy perspective, sustainability perspective, I mean, the two of you no doubt understand that office buildings are what are called an internal load-dominated building. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the energy, by far, in fact, the most energy that gets used in an office building goes to lights.
Right, yeah.
So what I proposed was to bring back some work done by a gentleman named William Lamb, who, Curtis, you said you had the pleasure of meeting.
Yeah, I met Bill Lamb when I was at GSD up at Harvard Graduate School of Design. Very self-effacing, very humble, very brilliant architect, and I think he was an architect. But in any case, for sure he was an engineer and a lighting designer, and the Lamb Lighting Company was the standard for direct, indirect valence lighting in the 70s and 80s. I think they may have been acquired by somebody else by now, but... Mm-hmm. He took a very simple concept of putting a curved surface, a curved so that it displayed light up and down in front of a strip of linear illumination source, which in those days was fluorescent light, and cast light off the ceiling and off a wall so as to bring light into a space totally indirectly, and it's the most efficient way to bring lighting into a small space like a corridor, and you will see these fixtures everywhere on the Harvard campus. They work very, very well. So, but then I suppose that Mr. Lamb had other ideas that I was not aware of.
Well, if I understand his career correctly, he had the company doing the lighting fixture you're talking about first, and from there, he went on and had a pretty lengthy career doing daylighting and sunlighting and lighting design for buildings. And he developed and tested and built and validated and improved and built again a series of buildings as a consultant working with other architects that utilized direct sunlight reflected into the building from the outside, so reflected on exterior reflectors. And that work, I think, has been, it addresses the core issues with office buildings, which is, from an energy perspective, the lighting is what uses energy. And from a lighting design perspective, the problem is that you have way too much light around the perimeter of the building and none at the interior.
Right.
So he developed this work that I think, as far as I can tell, has been forgotten. And what I tried to do is to bring that forward in this competition design and basically design big, large-scale light shelves that redirect, that reflect visible light into the office building, both via light shelves around the perimeter, but also via an atrium and light shelves with a simple single-axis heliostat at this atrium I was proposing to carve out of the building. Fortunately, the building was proportioned such that, you know, it's a fairly wide, low, boxy office building, like GSA, sort of typical.
Well, you've thrown off a lot of words here. Large scale, light. Jack, can we take just 30, a minute of clocks next track, please, so I can think about this. You know, you got to take a little break every so often, especially when you start throwing around those 25-cent words. Light shelves, we know. Jake has done a project in Utah with fairly...
a few projects, yeah. Bryan College Library and the one in Utah. Yeah,
but your
Utah
light
Valley
shelves were
University.
Fairly shallow.
Well, it's a matter of proportion, that's
in
all.
In the XY plane.
Yeah, it's just a matter of proportion. It could be a roof or it could be a series of... But if they're narrow, they also prevent direct sunlight from coming in and glare.
So they're going to be part sunbreaker or brise soleil and part light shelf.
They're both,
So Ryan, in your interpretation of Bill Lamb's concepts, how deep were your light shelves?
Well, they're pretty big, and for two reasons.
How big? How big?
Like 6 feet, something like that. I forget.
6 feet deep. 6 feet deep? Deep, deep,
something,
deep.
Yeah, six, maybe four, somewhere in that range.
Like,
but for two reasons. Let me. Number one, being that the goal for me, this is something that Lamb sort of philosophically felt was important, was to preserve large sort of expanses of vision glass. So you don't want to have these kind of louvers covering the entire facade. In his view. Because it makes you feel like you're in a prison when you're inside the building. And I agree.
Not if you have a double-height facade and you leave the bottom open. Take a look at my website, man.
Right. No, I'm
Pride of authorship will get you nowhere, Mr. Allspector.
Well, the double-height also allows you to drive the light further into the building because you get more bounce.
And the other reason in this competition entry they're so deep is that the building is oriented near east-west. It's the long sides of the building. It's kind of the worst scenario. So it forces the light shelves to be deeper in order to get the cutoff angles that you need. And in fact, it also really wants you want in the lower portion of the window where you have the vision glass in order to prevent glare. You really need sort of a auxiliary vertical sun blocking device of some sort. Even though the light shelves are so deep, they're not quite deep enough.
Not when the sun sets, right?
Exactly. And because this building happens to be oriented about 45 degrees to cardinal...
Or
you
rises.
Have
Or what?
Or rises. Although
right.
It's not a big issue in the morning because the heat, you know, flywheel effect of the Earth.
Or the ambient air temperature is low and the Earth is cool. Yeah, okay. Thanks for getting Ryan off the track, Jake.
But the point being, are we having a conversation here? But it's exactly the point is that the sun is low. Those angles, the building is oriented such that most of the facades of the building get a lot of that morning and evening light, and those sun angles are very low. That forces the light shelves to be deeper to give you the cutoff angles that you're looking for. And once those light shelves are such a big construction, you know, I started to put plants, and I think you reacted primarily to the plants, but I started to add other things to try and get a little bit more value for this, you know, somewhat significant construction that you'd have to make.
Yeah, what I saw in your schematic perspective sections, what looked like biomass. I mean, it looked like a sort of a kudzu forest just inside the passive glass facade.
Well, I think that may have been a fault of my rendering, because it really is meant to be a single layer of glass at the usual point. And the outer layer was just meant to be a trellis to carry planting, so that the plants can climb and begin to screen some of that.
Plantings on the outside.
Exactly.
That are seasonally, therefore, variable. In the summertime, they have leaves, in the winter, they don't.
Right, right. If you're really, really skilled with the plants, that's the idea. Exactly.
Interesting. Let's take just another little break and talk about these big issues of managing the weather. Yes, that is Prokofiev from his ballet Romeo and Juliet, the Dance of the Nights. You know, when as architects we're dealing with weather and all these natural resources that otherwise vex us, you know, too much sun, not enough sun, it's like having to deal with the movement of tectonic plates, which is why that I like that piece of music.
A little more predictable, one would hope.
Did we lose Ryan?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, okay. You're just lost.
I'm with you.
You're lost in a reverie with the music, no doubt.
So, as always, with your programming, Curtis.
Well, thank you so much. Flattery will give you everything and get you everywhere. How did you do in this GSA competition?
Well, I certainly didn't win. That's how I did.
Well, why the hell not? Why didn't you write to your member of Congress?
I don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. Wait. You're in
He's
Long
the
Island.
Wiener man. You can't write to him now. Forget it. You're
actually,
done.
No, I'm not. I'm not.
You're not represented by Anthony?
No.
Wiener?
No.
Well, that's good. Is it
Wiener? I don't know.
Is it properly Wiener or Wiener?
To be quite disappointing.
I think Wiener is more apropos.
Who knows why?
Well, okay. So the idea, so this layer. Well, what's the URL for this bit of ink that you got?
Well, Inhabitat is a green design blog.
Inhabitat, Inhabitat.
That's right. They did a little interview with me.
.com, .org, .net.
I think it's .com. Inhabitat.com.
About what? About when was this?
A couple weeks ago.
Okay, so sometime in the late days of May, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it's probably still on their front page or the second page back. It's at my website also, under Federal Office Building, Los Angeles.
That's on RyanEnchity.com?
Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
Now, how does this square with your dedication, for what it's worth, to Passive House? I mean, have you ever thought of doing a passive house approach to an office building? And what would that mean?
Well, it would mean a very good building envelope, similarly to the residential construction that we talked about previously. But what's interesting is that because office buildings they're larger and they're more simple volumes typically, they have, and because they're internal low-dominated buildings, they're easier to make into passive houses. Larger buildings have a lower surface-to-volume ratio and are easier to get to those kind of levels of energy efficiency.
So you could have a glass facade in a passive house and still make it?
Well, I don't know. I have never run the numbers for a office building using the modeling software that you use for passive house, but I know that it's been done in Europe now.
Huh. Well,
I don't know if a glass skin has been done, but office buildings and commercial buildings and large multifamily residential buildings are now being done as certified passive houses in Europe.
Right. In Europe, the criteria for the depth of a building, a commercial building, is different than in the United States. They really regulate the depths on their workstation can be more than, like, you know, 25 feet or 30
right.
feet
in Germany,
from
you
a
have,
window
right.
that's operable, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. German building codes require
It's not just German. I think it's all of Europe.
I think so. Well, in Germany, you have to be something like 15 meters from a window.
Yes.
And you have to be able to see outside from anywhere that you're working.
It's less. I thought it was 10 meters.
Okay.
No doubt that helps.
Yeah. And you have
well,
to
right away, that makes the whole strategy of daylight harvesting, you know,
much easier.
But also, the climate in Europe is a little different. It's actually more moderate than we have here. So
sure, they don't have the
there's certain things
cold.
That'll work that right. won't work for us that or that need supplement, you know, supplementary whatever.
Yeah, we've got a gigantic array range of climate zones in this country.
Even here, you could go from 3 below to 103.
Yeah, New York is much more extreme than Germany.
Chicago is even worse. You could go.
I mean, I'm
to
not talking about going up in the Alps, but you know,
yeah,
regular.
Yeah, Chicago could be 15 below to 110.
Absolutely.
And any given year, and even in Minneapolis, you could hit 100, and routinely they hit 135 below Fahrenheit.
Right.
That's 135 degrees Fahrenheit. That's 100 degrees Celsius of range. That's huge.
Well, I think the biggest problem with the deep American office buildings, Ryan, you correct me if I'm wrong, is that the load produced by the equipment and everything on the interior, as you maybe suggested, produces positive energy that you can redistribute to do work for you. But
right.
that's when the building's occupied and up and running and things like that.
Right.
Well, usually all the equipment that's in the building just adds to your AC load, I think.
Right.
Well, but it generally that is the worst part of it because of the summertime problem with AC and energy.
Right.
But if you had a narrow building, you wouldn't have that issue. You would have much more surface area.
Yeah.
The ratio of perimeter to floor area would be, you know, tighter and
sure.
you could ventilate it easier.
Sure, if your core is like 8...
Wouldn't need the lights on all the time.
If your core is 8 to 10 meters... And the workspace is another 10 meters. You're talking about 30-meter building.
Well, like the buildings by Foster, like the Commerce Bank in Frankfurt, is a wonderful example of being able to, you know,
or even the,
mediate and control
or even the big Gherkin, which is mostly volume.
I don't think they're net.
Of air.
I don't think they're net zero or passive house criteria, but certainly they probably draw energy, but solve some of the problems associated with it, right?
What's cool about addressing the lighting issue is that when you can turn off the lights, then you're reducing a lot of the heating load, as I'm sure you guys are know
sure.
better than I. The heating, a lot of the cooling load comes...
That's right.
A lot of the air conditioning is because of you got to cool off all the light all the heat generated by the lights.
Right.
So when you are able to increase levels of natural light in the building to a meaningful level... And when you're able to distribute it through the floor plate in a meaningful way, you can also, and you're able to turn off those lights. Not only do you reap the savings of the lights being turned off, but you reap the savings of the air conditioners being able to be turned off more.
Yeah. What's which just makes me think of a very interesting emerging trend. On the one hand, we have ASHRAE for heating, cooling, and ventilating. On the other hand, there have been prescriptive building code requirements for the amount of illumination that you needed in a workspace. Now, back in the 20th century, when Jake and I went to architecture school, there was an unwritten understanding that everything needed to be uniformly illuminated to 60 to 70 foot candles. But now, with prescriptive energy codes that limit us to something like 3 watts per square foot, you can't do that. Let's talk about the opportunities.
That makes indirect lighting harder, by the way.
Right, right. Gets us towards a combination of daylight and task light. Let's have just another musical break.
That party sounded good.
Welcome back to Burning Down the House here on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Curtis B. Wayne here with Jake Allspector in studio and Ryan Enchetti through the genius of telecommunications. So we as architects are now in a position of being able to do a little bit of jazz. I mean, we can do a little improv. We can step away from the universally illuminated world of yesteryear and put light where it wants to be, which is very exciting for me. What say you, gentlemen, my colleagues, about that?
Oh, I totally agree. It reminded me of, not to talk about my own work too much, but we
it's allowed.
Well, I've been renovating Philip Johnson's library at NYU.
At Bobst.
Bobst Library. And it was talk about universal illumination systems. You know, of course, that was designed in the mid-60s.
Right.
It's just seas of regimented fluorescent light with a few areas that are a little more decorative lighting, but most of it was that. And when we renovated it, we went into chiaroscuro mode to kind of put the light both task oriented but also to play with light and dark instead of this even kind of pall that sort of just kind of totalitarian
light.
Yeah,
I mean, you don't need 50, 60 foot candles in a corridor that you're just walking down.
That's right.
Yeah.
Have you played with that at all in your practice, Ryan?
Well, I think to the extent that I have, it's in this kind of stuff. I haven't gotten into the details of that kind of lighting design ever yet.
It'll come. No, I mean, if you get into corporate interiors at all, you'll be able to play with that. You'll be able to do a little jazz, a little improv. Yeah.
Well, indirect is still good, but today's workplace actually doesn't demand as much lighting, also because the computers are self-illuminated. I mean, our devices are now self-illuminated, and that's where many of us do our work.
Right, to the extent that we're not looking at hard copy.
That's
but if
correct.
We're looking at hard copy, there is always the
task light.
The task light,
right.
The desk lamp, which increasingly what's available is a retro replacement LED
those
lamp
things.
That will go into you know, any sort of screw base that you're looking for.
Right.
I mean, those are starting to happen.
But there's also the kind of indirect task system, which you can put under cubbies and things like that.
Yeah.
Which I think is very good, actually, because it gives you what
you
know, like, Lamb was talking about.
Right. Like
except
the,
on
like
a smaller
the,
scale.
Like the under... Like the under cabinet lights in a kitchen that illuminate
same
your
idea.
Workshop
exactly the
surface.
Same idea.
Yeah. These are all...
And then you backlight the computer so it doesn't give you glare on the screen. So
that's always
cool
important.
Too.
Although when viewing movies on the TV, there's always a great debate about light
backlighting
in the
versus not.
Yeah, light in the room versus
just think
not
of the retinal image, that's all.
I'm always for a little bit of ambient light.
Me too.
And I have had
endless
debates about no, it must be all dark. Well, this is not the movie theater, and even in the movie theater there is ambient light.
Right.
There are the step lights and the exit lights, and
I think if you're really close to the screen, you don't need ambient light. But if you're,
I've got a 25-inch. CRT flat screen TV, so you know it's at a distance, and
yeah,
I kind of
depends
need.
If you have your reading glasses on or not. Right.
So, moving forward, let's get back to Ryan. You know, he was good enough to let us take some time away from his Sunday afternoon, which would otherwise be spent with his daughter. Yes.
Yes, indeed.
How's she doing?
Well, I hope she's all right. She's she's not with me for 10 minutes.
Oh dear.
She's across the with my neighbors.
Oh, that's nice. But you're here in the city where you know there are communities and there are people who know each other just across the street. Something which we'll get into in the future about the anomie, which is that's a deep sociological term for alienation on a vast social scale of the suburbs, something that I have recently escaped. Thank you.
Yes, welcome back to the city.
Welcome back to civilization.
Thank you.
It's good that you survived. Some don't ever make it back out of there.
It's true. Not so many people do make it back,
no,
do
it's
they?
It's really true. It's hard.
There were some that I knew there, out there in Yankee Land in Connecticut, who said, "Well, why are you doing that? It's so noisy and busy and dense." And you know, this morning I took a little 5-minute walk from my new apartment on Amsterdam Avenue over to Riverside Park, and I had more open space than I had had.
Yeah.
Within walking distance, see?
Within walking distance when I lived in Rowayton, Connecticut.
Yep.
That's what I love about Riverside Park, is that open space across the river.
Yeah.
That's a great space.
I mean, there was a lot of open green space, you know. Over there, a couple blocks away, there were people
Olmsted again.
Having a rally
Park
for
Riverside.
Myasthenic gravis or something, and they were, you know, making their noise. But you'd walk a little bit further, and there was just nothing. You know, it was just me and...
The birds.
My good squeeze, Miss Kathy. Met Kathy.
Yes.
And the fog, you know, and the river. It was quite beautiful. And I could not be happier.
Sunday morning in New York.
That's something to talk about in the future. City planning, green space, the need for green space in the city.
But, you know, it's all part of the same thing. You know, I'm so glad you have Ryan on the program because... I mean, I'm not familiar with your work. I looked at it on my BlackBerry on the way over. But you know what? Your website doesn't work on my damn BlackBerry. But there's something weird about it. But, my thesis back in 1972 was the self-sufficient farm. So
really?
And no one would talk to me.
Well, no.
And then since then, I also worked on some solar energy projects after the oil crisis for... which, you know, were very interesting and educational. And it's so great that it's become focus again because I felt very lonely.
Yeah, all that stuff has been kind of forgotten. And it's kind of, some of it's coming back, but a lot of it is still kind of forgotten.
It's
and
still
I think
forgotten,
this,
but
this
not, by,
piece,
not lost.
Not lost, but, you know, what's the difference if it's not...
Well, it's still there to be tapped into. Lost means you've lost it.
Right. We never lost Bucky Fuller's ideas. That's we just misplaced them for a while.
And there's something I saw recently about the whole Earth catalog and things.
Well, we
like
misplaced that for a while.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if you know Stuart Brand could bring it back, what a wonderful thing that would be.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that was
the internet now, I think, is the whole Earth catalog.
I think the internet is the whole Earth catalog of our day, back in the 20th century.
Does he have a website, maybe?
No, only his
whole Earth website.
He's got fanzines all about what he used to do, you know, 45 years ago.
He's changed a bit of his tune, I remember. I can't remember exactly.
Oh, now he's for Big Iron and Massive
Capitalism?
No, there
was some surprising thing, like nuclear energy or something like that.
Well, nuclear energy in and of itself needs to evolve, in my opinion. We can't be storing 70,000 metric tons of nuclear waste every year. I mean, where the hell are we going to put it? We can't shoot it into space.
Everyone takes a little bit home.
Yeah.
Do you know somebody actually proposed that?
Take a little bit home and
everybody had a orange-sized ball of nuclear waste embedded in lead, you know, like Superman's.
Yeah, how great. Kryptonite.
Right?
Yeah.
And everyone had stewardship over their own little piece, of course. In no time at all would people sell them for
great profit. Well, that's a stupid idea. You know, the world is full of stupid ideas, and to circle back around to the notion of the state of architectural criticism, it's kind of stupid, in my mind, to be talking about works of architecture as if they were pieces of sculpture in the landscape, because buildings operate on so many different levels. To the editors of the New York Times, I say, you can do better than, well, you've already decided you can do better than Nikolai Orisov, and by the way, you can really do a lot better than Sarah Williams Goldhagen, in my opinion. I throw my hat into the ring. I am available. See what I can do as an architect and a thoughtful critic, a frequent critic of our built environment. Give me the opportunity and I'll see you, and I'll raise you 10. Anyway, this has been Burning Down the House here on Heritage Radio Network with Jake Allspector, Ryan Enchity. Thank you for listening. Keep the faith. It only gets better. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. The new Whole Foods market in Fairfield, Connecticut, is going to be generating their own clean power on site with a PureCell, that's a registered trademark, System Model 400 from UTC Power. I'm going to quote now from Tristan Coffin, the Green Mission Specialist for Whole Foods Markets, Northeast Region. In connection to our company's green mission, we are very proud to be reducing our carbon footprint while producing clean energy in our new Fairfield, Connecticut location. UTC Power has been a great local partner in implementing our fuel cell to help us reduce our environmental impact in the Fairfield community. By generating most of its power on site with the fuel cell, the Whole Foods market in Fairfield will prevent the release of more than 847 metric tons of carbon dioxide annually, the equivalent of planting more than 85 acres of trees. The reductions in nitrogen oxide emissions compared to a conventional power plant are equal to the environmental benefit of removing more than 100 cars from the road. In addition to the reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, the PureCell system will allow Whole Foods Market to save nearly 3.5 million gallons of water annually. Unlike central generation and other fuel cell technologies, the PureCell system is designed to operate in water balance, so there is no consumption or discharge of water during its operation. That's an awesome story. Kudos to Whole Foods. Don't you love that? This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Check out a small clip of Chef Smarty Pants, a.k.a. Erica Wides, talking about radishes on her show, Why We Cook.
Those supermarket radishes were like that. They were all heat and no flavor and woody and tough, and they were always kind of beat up and buggy looking, and they looked like crap. I don't understand why they were sold. They were in that plastic bag all sealed up for like 6 months. Why buy them? We always put them into our salad growing up, and I would just pick them out. And my mom still buys them. She still buys those bags. To me, those bags of radishes are like the ultimate symbol of industrial produce. They're grown for size and for color, but they taste like balls of wood dipped in nail polish remover. I don't understand why people would eat them. So I never understood the appeal of the radish until...
Want to hear more? Tune in live to Why We Cook every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m., where you can find all the old shows on our archives. Also, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. Thanks for listening. The following is a message from HeritageFoodsUSA.com. The difference between wild Alaskan salmon and farmed Atlantic salmon is just as great as the differences between commodity pork and heritage breed pork. Huge! HeritageFoodsUSA.com is lining up a major social buy of sustainably harvested salmon in July and offering it at a phenomenal price to consumers. Check out HeritageFoodsUSA.com for more details on how to get in on this opportunity. Experience salmon the way it should be. The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat.